new year is not starting off on a happy note for workers at some of the country's largest tech companies.
Wayfair announcing it's preparing to lay off at least 13%.
About a dozen major companies announced job cuts, including Amazon and Google's parent Alphabet.
Have been laying off a staggering amount of workers.
Big investments in AI, but it doesn't include hiring or even retaining human beings.
Well, on this show, we have talked about layoffs at the LA Times and other big media companies. The tech industry is also hemorrhaging jobs. You can add eBay, Duolingo, and TikTok to that list we just heard. However, the stock market is booming. The Dow and the S&P 500 both hit records this week, driven primarily by tech stocks, by the very companies that are laying off workers. So, what gives? Roger Lee is going to try to help us answer that question. He tracks tech layoffs via his website, layoffs.fyi. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So you have tracked tech layoffs since the pandemic began, but I'm just looking at your figures right now. And you report that 72 tech companies around the world have laid off more than 13,000 workers so far just this year, so just this month. And we're not even at the end of the month. So what's behind this latest wave?
January has been off to a bad start for tech layoffs. And in fact, that number is now over 21,000 as of today, employees laid off. That's following a brutal 2023, where over 260,000 employees have been laid off in the tech sector. And all of this is part of this, you know, years-long wave of a tech company laying off to correct for their overhiring during the pandemic surge. Mm-hmm. This has been going on since mid-2022 and has continued as the high interest rate environment and tech downturn have lasted longer than initially expected.
And is there a direct link between these layoffs and the high stock price?
Well, we're certainly seeing that in this current economic environment, investors are prioritizing profitability and no longer willing to fund money-losing companies or companies that have expenses spiraling out of control. And so that is a big reason why you're seeing these major tech companies and even smaller startups focus more on cost cutting, which has led to these layoffs. And in fact, you know, the Mag 7 stocks have been rewarded for these cost cuts. So companies like Amazon and Google and Meta, Microsoft, all of which have done major layoffs in the past year, have seen their stock prices rise. And so Wall Street has been rewarding them for their focus on cost discipline.
Those companies are also investing heavily in AI. And there is a narrative going around that it's actually AI that is what's behind this, that these companies are finding it cheaper and easier to use robots, for lack of a better word, than human beings.
Well, AI is a convenient narrative for these layoffs because it has been such a hot topic over the past year. Although I think in reality, it's still a little bit too early to tell what impact AI is actually going to have on the labor market. Most of the tech layoffs that have been happening have been the result of the macroeconomic environment and not so much AI itself. Although we are finding that an increasing number of tech companies have at least been citing AI as maybe not the main reason, but certainly a reason for the layoffs. You have companies like Dropbox and Meta that are shifting their resources to focus more on AI talent, even as they eliminate jobs elsewhere in the organization. And even some companies like IBM have implied that AI may mean that they might not need as many employees in the future.
But when it comes to Meta, what you're saying is that it's not necessarily that AI is replacing jobs. It's that the focus is on developing AI, and that's where they're hiring. So they're laying off workers in other divisions.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So when it does come to firing employees in exchange for artificial intelligence, what jobs in particular are vulnerable?
Well, it's, again, too early to tell for sure exactly, you know, specific roles that are being eliminated and directly replaced by AI. I don't think we're quite there yet in terms of understanding the impact of AI. But just the chatter has been, you know, for example, that companies may not need as many customer support people going forward because AI can help with some of that function. And so that's certainly a vulnerable role. And then even when it comes to engineers, companies who are investing more in AI are now seeking engineers that can directly help with their AI initiatives. Mm-hmm. So it might mean that they're hiring folks with AI expertise or engineers on their AI teams. And that could mean in conjunction with cutting engineers in other parts of the business that maybe aren't as core or aren't as related to their AI initiatives.
Okay, a prime beneficiary of this interest in AI is NVIDIA. Can you talk about the case of NVIDIA? Because their stock has gone up like 400% plus recently. And it seems to be, you know, one of the hottest performing stocks, hottest performing companies in Silicon Valley right now. And that's because they bet big on AI. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. You know, NVIDIA makes chips that are being used for AI, and they have been the biggest beneficiary of this AI boom, even more so than the other big tech companies. If you think about other Mag 7 companies like Amazon or Google, Meta, Microsoft, and so on, they have pretty broad businesses. So AI is a big growth area for them, but they have a broad array of product and services that have been sold for a long time. And so AI is kind of just one future bet. But for NVIDIA, AI is just a much more important part of their business and a much bigger part of their growth. And so they have been really a big beneficiary, both in their share price and in their financials because of the AI boom. And so that's why we're kind of seeing a lot of attention in NVIDIA for the past year. You know, they've been around for decades now, but have never quite been thought of as in the same tier or stratosphere as the Amazon, Google, Microsofts, Facebooks of the world. And now because of AI, they are now in that same league.
Oh, wow. Also, Tesla's in that group of Magnificent Seven, too.
That is true. Yes. Yeah. That's right.
Okay. So when you said at the outset that 260,000 plus jobs were lost last year on top of the 21,000 this month, that just seems like an earthquake. What does that tell you about the larger economy?
Well, what we've seen so far is that tech has suffered the most over the past couple of years because that sector is the most vulnerable to high interest rates. And despite predictions and warnings suggesting that the rising interest rate environment would affect the economy more broadly, you know, lead to greater unemployment, lead to a potential recession, that actually hasn't really happened. Employment numbers are still really strong on a monthly basis. Broadly speaking, we have yet to dip into the recession that many had feared would happen. And so far, a lot of the carnage really has been contained to the tech sector. Now, that's not to say that there hasn't been pain elsewhere. We're certainly seeing layoffs everywhere. And, you know, the LA Times layoff recently is an example of that. But by and large, the tech sector has felt it a lot more worse than the rest of the economy. And hopefully with interest rates subsiding and declining potentially as soon as this year, we'll hopefully see that the rest of the economy can still be resilient even as tech is going through this downturn.
All right. Roger Lee is the founder of layoffs.fyi, which tracks job cuts in the tech industry. Roger, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It took just minutes for some people in San Diego to become waist deep in flood water as rain fell fast and furious Monday morning. Cars were swept away. Some people actually had to scramble to their rooftops and beg for help. Hundreds are now at least temporarily homeless, and the cleanup will cost millions of dollars. But this was not a hurricane. It was what city officials call a once-in-a-thousand-year storm. These storms, though, are becoming more common because of global warming. Storms that Southern California and everywhere, really, are really not built to withstand. Brett Sanders is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Irvine, where he runs their flood lab. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you. Well, I guess you're pretty busy. figuring out what's happening with these increasing intense storms. And so what did you think when you saw this rainfall the way it did on Monday?
I was a little surprised at first. I live not far from San Diego in Orange County, and we had a wet day, but it wasn't super intense rainfall. I was just reminded how localized the rainfall can be along the West Coast. And, you know, storms can hit one community and not another one. Mm-hmm. And so it just, you know, pulled me into seeing what was going on and what was being impacted. And it was a real severe event.
And similar to what happened last month in Oxnard, right? There was that really intense period of rain and flooding there that didn't affect other communities as much.
Right. The way the weather systems come off the ocean, they tend to sort of concentrate their impact in one part of the coastline. And those areas really get stressed. The, you know, the rain hits the ground, it runs off very quickly. We have really covered the ground of Southern California with a lot of concrete and hard surfaces. So the water just runs off really quickly and it creates these really dangerous flows.
Is there any way to know ahead of time which community will be hit hardest when a storm is coming?
The short-term forecasts are pretty good showing where the moisture is heading. So if you're looking out, say, you know, 6 or so hours in advance, you can get a pretty good handle on which communities are being exposed. And that's what the public works managers and the emergency officials are doing as these storms come in. They're keeping an eye on where they're going to hit and trying to be ready if they do.
Well, it didn't seem like San Diego was adequately prepared, but then who could be for such an intense weather event in just a few short hours? So is this something that is just inevitable that there's going to be this kind of catastrophic flooding?
Well, there's always a chance that storms come in with an amount of rainfall that is beyond what infrastructure is designed to handle. We can only afford to build, you know, flood systems that contain a certain fraction of the storms that we experience. And so I think the message here is that anywhere in Southern California could experience these intense rainfall events. And we do need to do a better job of preparing for the possibility that the infrastructure is overwhelmed.
How do we do that? Because it takes a long time to build infrastructure. And as you say, we have covered Southern California with asphalt. So that just means rain can flow freely down our streets. What are some ways to mitigate that?
The first is realizing you're not going to build your way out of the problem. There will be times when flows go beyond the drainage system, and we ought to prepare for these events. We don't do a good job being ready for events that are beyond what infrastructure contains. And there are things we can do. For example, cities can map out in detail those areas that are most at risk. They can update the building codes so the buildings in those areas can tolerate floodwaters. They can take on, you know, community-based insurance so that when floods strike, those who are impacted immediately get some payouts to try to, you know, compensate for their losses and restore those communities and keep the businesses going. One of the biggest risks that communities face, especially more vulnerable communities, is sort of a cycle of disinvestment after these events. So events come, property is damaged, people leave, businesses close, and then you're left with an area that's sort of spiraling downwards.
But then you have insurance companies now canceling policies. I just got a notice that my fire insurance is being canceled because I live in California.
Yeah, the insurance companies are reeling from these growing flood risks, and they're being more careful about where they invest. But insurance companies will invest when there's an opportunity to run a business. And they have to kind of study the processes and realize where the, you know, the benefits make sense and they can offer a product that's affordable. The idea of community-based insurance is kind of a new idea. It's not that an individual property owner necessarily has a policy, but rather that like the whole city decides that they want to protect themselves from the possibility of a disaster that really undermines the economic strength of the city.
Yeah, and insurance policies don't cover a lot of flooding, I also realized after last winter. And so how do you know as a homeowner whether or not you will be covered if something like this happens?
You really need to check your policy carefully. One of the interesting, with flood insurance, anyone living in a federally defined floodplain can get access to a discounted flood insurance through the National Flood Insurance Program.
But we're not in that category here, right?
Yeah. So across California, the flood zones are often quite limited. And one of the reasons why is that FEMA does not map areas at risk of just rainfall flooding. We call that pluvial flooding. And that's a lot of what we see now with these really more intense rainstorms. So there are a lot of people who do face a real flood risk that aren't going to be in a flood zone, but they can turn to insurance providers and try to get a policy. The key is like knowing, is this policy a good value? And that's where we need better data, informing communities about who's at risk and who's not at risk and whether insurance might be a good idea for that property owner.
Well, it seems like we're all at risk now in Southern California.
That's not true. So, with flooding, it's some areas are definitely more at risk than others. If you live in a canyon ravine, like we saw in San Diego, yeah, that's a high risk. If you live up on a ridge or on a slope where water drains quickly, you may not face much flood risk. There's different risks facing different properties.
Do you think that our city leaders are adequately prepared, and our state leaders are adequately prepared and are taking this seriously and making the requisite changes?
Well, there's a lot of different people and a lot of different organizations doing, you know, different degrees of work to try to stay on top of flood risk. We need to sort of heighten our awareness, and we need to heighten our awareness because the fact that we've urbanized significantly across California over recent decades as we've built out our population. We've lived through years of drought, and we've sort of grown to accustomed to being like the drought is sort of normal. We don't get much rainfall here and we shouldn't be worried about it. But now the past 2 years, we've seen more intense rainstorms. We've seen what it's like to be in a wet year. And wet year combined with an urbanized California means a lot more areas potentially at risk of flooding.
Brett Sanders, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Irvine, where he runs their flood lab. Brett, thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, trees can't be racist, but their presence can be. That's the idea behind a new documentary that examines the fight in Palm Springs over a grove of trees that separated a black neighborhood from a golf course. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Palm Springs has long been a retreat for Southern California's wealthy elite, drawn to its hot, dry climate, its gorgeous mid-century modern architecture, and, of course, the Coachella Valley's more than 100 golf courses. For decades, an overgrown grove of trees separated one of those golf courses from one of the city's few predominantly black neighborhoods. Residents there say those trees were planted deliberately, intended to separate them from the golf course.
I feel segregated from it. I feel like I'm not a part of Palm Springs with that golf course and with those trees up. I feel like, why am I not on a golf course view? Why is my property value not going up gradually? What's going on? Well, they want to keep you down. They want to keep you there.
Well, Palm Springs Progressive City Council denied this and were dismayed to see the story become culture war fodder on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show a few years ago.
Now trees in Palm Springs are racist. Can you tell us how you reached this conclusion? What racist sentiments have they expressed to you? How can you prove these trees are racist?
Racist Trees is the name of a new documentary that debuted on PBS this week. It's directed by Mina T. Sun and Sarah Nguyen's, and they're both in the studio now. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right. So did you take the title from Tucker Carlson's rant there?
That's exactly right. We grabbed that from the headlines, and we figured it was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek way to grab people's attention and hopefully spark interesting conversations around racism in Palm Springs.
Okay, yeah. So trees, of course, cannot be racist in and of themselves, but the trees being in the place that they are were considered placed there as a racist act, kind of a barrier. And we've seen all sorts of barriers in different cities that separate people from people, neighborhoods from amenities, that kind of thing, be it freeways, walls, and in this case, trees. So can you set the scene for us? What do these trees look like and why were they considered a problem by the residents?
So I think one of the things that really captured our attention is that it's literally a wall of trees. They're about 50, 60 feet tall, 3 to 5 feet wide. And they are a non-native species, require a great deal of water, and just produce an incredible amount of debris.
All right, we have a clip that illustrates what you're talking about. Two residents here talking about what it's like to live right next to these trees.
It actually takes about a good 10 feet to 15 feet of my yard that I can't do nothing with. I used to have above ground pool in here, but the needles would blow so much I couldn't maintain it. So I took the pool out. My kids can't play back here, and they're nasty.
It's just a habitat for a lot of unwanted creatures. Rats, rodents, snakes. I can't cut the trees because it's not my property. But the city claims that they maintain these trees, but you clearly see you don't grow this in a matter of months. This grows over a matter of years.
So that's Charles Metcalf Jr., the last voice there, and you first heard from Kevin Williams. They both live in this neighborhood, and the neighborhood is called Crossley Tract. Tell us about the neighborhood and the history of it.
Yeah, so Lawrence Crossley bought this tract of land for Black families to eventually move to because previously, discriminatory housing practices, they were unable to live in the city of Palm Springs.
So Black people were not allowed to live in the city of Palm Springs. That was expressly forbidden?
I think there were a lot of different, whether it's loan practices or ways in affordability to be able to live in the city. And so they had to find other means and other housing. And so one of the areas that they were able to live in was an area in the 50s called Section 14 that was on tribal land, owned by the Agua Caliente Band of Cahuilla Indians. And so they were able to lease their land to Black families, Mexican families, a lot of the laborers who were working in the city at the time.
And then we've done a story on this, but you also talk a bit about this part of the history in your documentary that Section 14 then experienced a series of highly suspicious arsons where these Black families' homes were burned down. They would go to work and return home to a smoldering pile of embers.
Yes, exactly. So Section 14 is actually now where downtown Palm Springs exists. So it was very prime real estate. And in the late 50s and early 60s, city leaders figured out ways to forcibly remove many communities of color, not just Black families, from Section 14 so that they could make way for development.
Okay, so some of them then move to this Crossley Tract because it's outside the city limits, but then it becomes part of Palm Springs. How does that happen?
I think so Lawrence Crossley was able to buy that tract of land because it was specifically outside of the city. And then I think it was in the late 60s where it becomes a part.
It became incorporated over time, yeah.
Okay, so somehow these trees get planted, and a good portion of your documentary is kind of delving into the history of that. Like, how did those trees get there in the first place? But before we get to that, I want to talk about how this became a political issue, because it didn't really become a political issue, even though those trees were there for decades, until fairly recently. And a white guy named Trey Daniel becomes the main spokesperson to get rid of these trees. And he lives in Crossley Tract, but he doesn't live right next to the trees. Why is he so invested in this issue?
That's a great question, Madeline. It's something that we explore in the documentary, because he is a white resident, and it's in more recent years that the neighborhood began to gentrify a little bit. And he was someone who recognized that these trees were depressing property values for many of the homeowners, particularly the ones whose properties border this golf course owned by the city. So though the residents for many years had been complaining about the trees, specifically because no one was maintaining them, Trey really took the mantle and tried to get the attention of the city by pointing out the fact that these were potentially planted with racist intent. And many residents believe that's the case. And so it kept getting louder and louder as a way to get the city's attention.
And the city did finally pay attention. And there was a big news article, a couple of news articles written in the local paper. What did people say when this became an issue, when it became news? It ended up, as we heard, on Tucker Carlson and in news items around the world. What was the reaction in Palm Springs?
So I think the reaction in Palm Springs, depending on who you were talking to, was very interesting. I think the people of the community, I think, really welcomed the attention because I think they thought that something might finally be done, that their voices were being heard. On the other hand, we thought it was interesting that the city themselves did not want the attention, and it was a little bit an issue that they wanted to cover up quite quickly, it seemed, because we got involved as documentary filmmakers sort of right at the outset when the first Desert Sun article appeared, and then it was starting to gain traction. And so we had no idea where the story was going to go. We thought, okay, let's follow this. A lot of times with documentaries, you don't know if there is even an end or what would happen. But surprisingly, the issue sort of got resolved very quickly. And we think that it was because of all the attention, and the city sort of wanted to address it very quickly. Whereas in the beginning, it seemed as if maybe they weren't sure about taking down the trees. They were talking about how much it was going to cost. They needed to find the budget. And so I think for them, they just wanted it to go away as quickly as possible.
And you interview the mayor, who paints it as not a racist situation at all. I mean, did they actually think it was not racist and that it was? I mean, what did they think?
I think they were really searching for a reason to remove the trees and did a lot of legwork to find other reasons outside of racist intent. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that actually surprised us quite a bit, was the lengths to which they were going to try to prove otherwise, which, as if racism, you know, racist intent is something that you can actually prove. And so there was digging into Palm Springs history and looking at photographs and different things to try to get to the bottom of who planted these trees, when and why.
Well, they go back into the archives, which I thought was interesting, and actually find a photograph of the trees without the neighborhood. So is that their aha moment that, look, the trees were here, they were planted here before the neighborhood even existed, so therefore, ergo, it couldn't have been racist?
Exactly. That was one moment where J.R., the mayor pro tem who we were talking to, he was very excited to share this news, and he said, haven't you seen the photos? He was even sort of presenting the possibility that Lawrence Crosley may have planted the trees themselves. There's evidence that the trees have always been there. And, you know, when we were talking to Corinne Kennedy, the journalist in the Desert Sun, she sort of summed it up pretty well. And she said that photo doesn't really prove anything. If anything, it's almost like a inkblot test of you are going to see, you know, what you want from it. And I think it's a way to convince yourself whatever it is that you want to believe in.
Right. And you present the photos to some of the Crosley Tract residents, and here is how they responded.
These are tamarisk trees that are there already. Is that what the claim is? That the golf course was there and the trees were there before the homes were even being built?
Absolutely. No. I don't agree. I'm sorry.
You really can't tell what that is.
You wouldn't know those were tamarisks. It was just a little scratchy.
That's so interesting to hear that because, like you said, you know, people can read what they want into the photos. Do you think there is a way to really finally know who planted them and why?
There are no receipts. There's no documentation. And the conclusion that we draw in the film is that it was likely city leaders at the time who did plant it because of Frank Bogert, the mayor at the time, also owned the golf course. But there's really, in the end, no way to know. And then I think we also sort of just felt like it's not so important who planted them and why. It's much more important to listen to this community who's suffering today and not seeing their property values appreciate in the way that many people in Palm Springs get to.
I just want you to amplify what you were talking about earlier. The Palm Springs City Council is run by a gay mayor. They pride themselves in being left-wing and open-minded and LGBTQ friendly. And so they really didn't want to see themselves as carrying on a racist tradition, right?
Exactly. And I think a lot of people sort of even leaned on that they themselves had faced discrimination. And so they understand what it feels like to be discriminated against. And that actually was a very interesting reaction when we showed the film to Black audiences, where it was a little bit of like, oh, wow, you went there. But I think they genuinely felt like this wasn't about race and this wasn't about racism because of their own lived experiences.
Hmm. Okay, so is that one reason why they voted speedily to remove the trees?
Yeah, I think they wanted to resolve the issue as quickly as possible. And from our view, seemed more concerned at the idea of being racist rather than racism itself.
Hmm. Yeah. So how do they feel now? The trees have been removed. How do the people of Crosley Tract feel now?
I mean, I think they are overjoyed.
This is a beautiful view I get now. I feel like I'm Black and I'm part of Palm Springs. It was very emotional. At one point, I didn't think they would ever come out. But to see them now gone brings a tear to my eye because I see change in Palm Springs.
Not only am I still have the status of being on the golf course, I am a part of the golf course now as well. So I love it. It's a brand new day today. So
I think it was a real win for everybody.
And their property values, did they go up?
Yes, they went up quite a bit. I think there we saw something like
75 to 100%.
Oh, wow.
But it doesn't come without some downsides, which is that the neighborhood is gentrifying even more now because the property values have risen.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show today, and thank you for your movie.
Thank you so much for having us, Madeline.
Thank you.
That's Mina T. Sun and Sarah Nguyen's. Their documentary, Racist Trees, is available to stream now on the PBS app. Coming up,
Annette Bening, Lily Gladstone, Sandra Hulia, Carrie Mulligan, and Emma Stone.
Margot Robbie not on the Best Actress Oscar list, and Greta Gerwig wasn't nominated for Best Director either. Fans are not happy. They say those exclusions underscore the movie's message about the patriarchy. We'll discuss that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Barbie received 8 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, but fans are still angry. And that's because Greta Gerwig was not nominated for Best Director, and neither was Barbie herself, Margot Robbie, for Best Actress. Ken, a.k.a. Ryan Gosling, was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, underscoring, some say, the message of the film, boy power is everywhere. Joining me now is Michael Shulman, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears. Welcome back.
Hi.
All right. So everyone from the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation to Hillary Clinton has weighed in on this controversy. So what do you think?
The people are up in arms.
Yes.
For Barbie.
And the animals, too, I guess. So tell us, what was your reaction when you saw that Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie weren't nominated?
Well, it definitely stuck out to me as the sort of big Oscar story of the nominations and a surprise. I think people expected Barbie to do well, and it did. It got 8 nominations. And, a couple of I guess, disclaimers about sort of what is going on here. One of them is that both those people are nominated, but for other things. You know, yeah. Greta Gerwig is nominated for a screenplay with Noah Baumbach. Margot Robbie is nominated as a producer of the film under Best Picture. The movie did do well. It actually got a kind of surprise nomination in Best Supporting Actress for America Ferrera, and a whole bunch of other things. So it's not like the movie itself got totally ignored by the Academy. But to me, the fact that it missed out in Best Actress and Best Director kind of signaled an element of ambivalence from the voting body as a whole. And you kind of have to think it through to think what might that mean. I mean, for one thing, all of these categories are voted on by different branches of the Academy. You know, the actors nominate for actors, the directors nominate for director, etc. So, you know, it's not like a cabal of 10 people who are all deciding this. It's you know, a huge number of thousands of people. Yeah. And what is it that they would throw 8 nominations at, you know, the highest grossing movie of the year, but not do these 2 very central categories?
Right. And so the directors, just to take that one, the group of the voters is something like 590 members or so. But most of them are men. So some people are saying, well, look, that just signals right there that she would have a hard time. And when you look at the history, very few women have been nominated in that category.
Absolutely. There's no question that gender has been a huge barrier in the directing category. And this year, we should say, an all-male lineup. Justine Triet, who directed the wonderful movie Anatomy of a Fall, is in there. And then, you know, I think all the choices are very strong. There's like Martin Scorsese, Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer. You know, directing is a really tough category because there's 10 Best Picture nominations and then 5 in directing. So 5 of those directors, at least aren't going to get in.
Right.
And I think it's fair for people to ask, okay, why did this woman, Greta Gerwig, who directed, you know, the highest grossing movie ever directed by a woman, how did she not get in here, especially when the direction of Barbie was so innovative and so successful and so beloved? And then, you know, Best Actress is like a different deal because there is no gender factor there. I mean, you know, the people who got in are all women by definition. And one of them, Lily Gladstone from Killers of the Flower Moon, is a historic nomination as a Native American woman, which has never happened. Hmm. So, yeah, you kind of have to look a little more beneath the hood. I understand the sort of Hillary Clinton angle of like, you know, you can't make it through that glass ceiling. But I feel like it's a little more complicated than that, given sort of the boring technicalities of how the Academy votes.
Yeah. And also the fact that it's a comedy, too. And the Academy, at least in this instance for the Oscars, likes to take itself very seriously and nominate big, important movies. Barbie, of course, was nominated, but I guess they, you know, but Oppenheimer received more nominations, 13, even though Barbie made more money at the box office. But so is there that too? They're kind of biased against the comedy, against the lighter fare, the pink versus
Absolutely.
The gray.
Absolutely. I think that's a real big part of it. The Academy is just always so bad at recognizing great comedic performances and also like big, fun blockbusters. What it reminded me of was actually Jaws from 1975, where that was, again, the biggest blockbuster of the era and totally game-changing for the industry. And it got nominated for Best Picture, but Steven Spielberg was snubbed in Best Director and none of the actors were nominated. It's sort of like you have these big populist hits and the Academy is a little, you know, they lean toward the big dramas that wear their importance with a lot of gravitas. And Oppenheimer definitely does that. So, you know, I feel like if you take the two of them, you know, they're constantly linked together because of Barbenheimer.
Yeah.
You know, Oppenheimer is like this perfect fit for an Academy movie. Barbie is a more confusing fit for the Academy because it is critically lauded. It was a huge success, but it's also, you know, bright pink and based on a doll, and like, how do we feel about this exactly in terms of awards? And once you and the thing is, you know, when you see all the awards it was nominated for and the ones that it wasn't, it's just a weird fit matching the nominations to the achievement, because, you know, it's nominated for all this other stuff, and yet these two major things are missing.
Is it also that Greta Gerwig is 40 years old and she's young? Martin Scorsese is maybe twice her age, if or more.
Well, she's been nominated before, you know? I mean, you know, Little Women. Little Women, to me, is like an easier movie for the Academy to wrap its mind around, because, you know, it's based on a, you know, a famed literary classic, and there's a more of an obvious prestige element to it.
Right. So, but was she nominated for Best Director for Little Women, or nominated for writing?
I think she was, but she also won. Didn't she win for writing for that?
Yeah, I think so, for writing. Anyway, we can Google check that later. But the point being that the Academy, too, doesn't, you know, it's long been criticized for not checking, not in being interested in popular movies as much as the audience is, and nominating films and awarding films that not a lot of people see. A lot of people saw Barbie.
Yes. By the way, I must correct myself. She was not nominated for director for that. She was nominated for screenplay for Little Women, which is the same case here.
Right.
So yeah. So I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I think the Academy from its beginning has always wrestled with like the tension between art and commerce, and, you know, what to do with like big populist hits. You know, I think of the very first Oscars in 1929 had two different categories for the top prize. One was outstanding production, which went to this big war epic called Wings, and the other was, you know, like unique and artistic achievement, you know, unique and artistic picture, something like that. So, mm-hmm. you know, they split it up between the little art house film and the big mega hit. And, you know, that was the only year they did that. Then those two things combined. But it's still a tension that I think the Academy has. Like, there are years where something like Titanic is this gigantic hit, and it's also a best picture. But then, you know, in past years, there have been, you know, like years where like a small little movie like Nomadland wins. Mm-hmm. And then the big mega hits are left out. So I think that's something the Academy is constantly wrestling with. The Academy leadership would love for more big blockbusters to be nominated for a lot of stuff, because it draws more viewers to the show.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot right now, and because we have a few seconds left. Who wins Best Picture if it were between Barbie and Oppenheimer? Just those two.
Oh, I think the easy bet right now is Oppenheimer for Best Picture.
Okay.
For sure. Although, who knows? Maybe this backlash against the, you know, the Barbie omissions will catapult it to success.
That's what I was thinking. Who knows? Politics.
There's always an angle.
Entered the chat. All right. Michael Shulman, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the book Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears. Always great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
Coming up, Evan Kleiman is here with homemade hot chocolate recipes for a cold night. So stay with us next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lunch?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
You know what that means. Time for our weekly treat. And speaking of treats, how about a toasty cup of hot chocolate? Not the generic, dusty, boring cocoa packets, but a real homemade and delicious chocolatey drink that you could have on a cold night, or it could be a good treat for Valentine's Day. Joining me now with some recommendations is Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Hello.
Hello.
All right. Because it's cold and stormy, we're going to talk about hot beverages. And not, as we said, the dusty Swiss Miss packets, but something really delicious, but also easy to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
we can get more refined than Swiss Miss.
I should hope so. And it's not too difficult to make it from scratch, right?
No. I mean, first of all, you don't have to make it from scratch. There are so many mixes available that are amazing. I mean, almost all good bean-to-bar chocolate makers create their own mix that you can buy from the Parisian Angelina Cafe hot chocolate mix and San Francisco's Dandelion chocolate mixes that you can buy online, to so many local versions. Like Valerie makes a great one that I love adding to coffee for an afternoon cup of mocha. Choco Vivo in Culver City, in addition to, like, you can go there and look at their amazing menu of hot chocolates and choose to drink it there, but they have several choices of drinking chocolates that you can buy. La Monarca sells both Mexican hot chocolate mixes and a champurrado mix, which we'll talk about. And talented people like Mila, who's known for her fantastic bonbons we've talked about in the past, she also makes, like, a really high quality drinking chocolate mix.
Yum. Okay. And we can make our own too, though, right?
Oh, yeah. It's so easy. And people seem to fixate on this around the holidays to make it for gifts. But I say make it as a gift for yourself.
Yes, I endorse that wholeheartedly.
I link to a couple of different ways of making the mix. One from Clements of Gourmandise uses cocoa powder, sugar, and milk powder, so you don't need to worry about having milk. She also adds malted milk powder, which I think is a power move. Melissa Clark uses cocoa powder confectioner's sugar, which gives it good body. She also adds chopped chocolate and no milk powder. But that's the great thing about making it yourself. You can customize. You can use natural cocos or Dutch processed cocoa powders or a mix.
Can you just melt chocolate and put some hot milk in it and call it a day?
100%.
Really?
In fact, yeah, of course. I mean, that's really how I make it.
Why have I never done that?
I don't know. In fact, this is the reason. I have chocolate in the house more for this than for eating chocolate. I know that's, like, people won't believe me, but it's true. I have a video of Clemence making her French hot chocolate, which she starts with a ganache, you know, a mixture melting just cream and chocolate, and then she thins that out with milk to, you know, whatever level you want.
So it's not a locale dish.
Well, you know, originally Mexican chocolate, the Aztec version, was made with water. And you can still do that. You don't have to use milk, but we are, you know, programmed to want it, like, creamy and luxurious.
Mm. All right. Well, that's a good segue, because I wanted to talk about Mexican hot chocolate. What is it and how is it different aside from using water?
Obviously, I love Mexican hot chocolate. It's based on the tablets or tablillas that you can buy that are made with stone ground bittersweet chocolate, cinnamon, and a hint of sugar. Mexican chocolate has that grainy, it's like a characteristic grainy consistency that you either embrace or you don't. And there's now many different varieties of more, quote, artisanal versions of the tablillas. Of course, there's the famed, you know, old line brand Abuelita. Taza, I think, also makes them. You can just, once you start looking for these kinds of products, you know, of course, you find millions of them. But I also really love champurrado, which is basically like Mexican hot chocolate, but it's thickened with masa harina. Mm-hmm. And extra cinnamon. I really love thickened hot chocolates.
Can you use cornstarch?
Cornstarch, that would be Spanish style. Spanish style is basically making your hot chocolate with milk or creamer or a combo, and then thickening it with cornstarch until it's almost like a pudding. And of course, if you have a churro on the side, more the better.
Mm. Yes. And then there's, of course, the OG Viennese. Right.
Oh, my goodness. I love the Viennese. They just are so excessive. With the Viennese style, egg yolks are beaten in to thicken the liquid. And, of course, it's topped mit Schlag with whipped cream.
Of course.
The real stuff.
Mm, delish. All right. You have links for all of this at the website, right?
Of course, including one to the library of hot chocolate recipes from Binging with Babish, which takes you from basic through French, Viennese, Italian, and another wild card. And we have a video with Clémence of Gourmandise making her ganache-based hot chocolate.
Okay, go check that out at kcrw.com. Evan Kleinman hosts KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear Saturday mornings at 10. You can subscribe to the podcast and to Evan's newsletter at kcrw.com/goodfood. And Evan, what is on Good Food this week?
This week, we look at the Afghan kitchen, which just sounds so incredibly delicious, the way that author Zarguna Adel proposes in her cookbook. You know, I think we all know that last year was not kind to restaurants in L.A., so I have a conversation with food columnist Stephanie Brejo talking about some of the closings from the past year. We also talk to a shawarma chef, Yaz Sudani from Mia Mia, who tells us his story of bringing chicken shawarma he learned to make while in Amman, Jordan, to Smorgasburg. And then we also have a couple of Hmong stories this week. One centers one woman's struggle to survive war, loss, and displacement while holding on to her identity. That comes from Lisa Hamilton, who's an amazing author. And then we focus on the first Hmong American cookbook.
All right. Awesome. That is Good Food. Again, it's on the radio at 10 o'clock this Saturday. Evan Kleinman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline. Always a pleasure.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget to follow us on the socials. We are at KCRW. I am at The Mad Brand. And I'll be back with you again tomorrow. So catch us then. Until then, have a great day.